You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Or did I talk to the time pilot?
Someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil. There's no place for ghost stories in this investigation or any other.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
Hi, I'm Madigan, and you're listening to Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist, a podcast that explores the world through a personal feminist perspective. As listeners of the show probably know, I've had a long history of fascination with cults. It probably started with learning about Charles Manson and the Manson girls when I was far too young to be learning of such tragedies. But when I was young, cults seemed like something so out there and bizarre that it couldn't be something that you or I could ever experience. But as I got older, my fascination with cults turned to one of trying to understand. Understanding the psychology of cult members and their leaders, how someone gets involved in a high control group, and what that does to our minds. I first heard of NXIVM when it was all over the news in 2018. Keith Raniere had been arrested and charged with acts such as identity theft, conspiracy, sex trafficking, and even slavery. Keith had been running one cult or another through an MLM/pyramid scheme outline since the 1980s, and had been evolving as an evil cult leader ever since. By the time my guest today, India, met Keith in 2011, Keith was running his ESP courses, or executive success programs. These were intended to help people overcome their, quote, limiting beliefs like phobias and fears in order to become more successful people. The courses cost a buttload, and students were asked to recruit more and more people into taking the classes, bringing more and more people into Raniere's circle. In many of these classes, students would undergo something called an EM, or exploration of meaning, which is a process where a person is forced to share a painful or traumatic memory from their past so they can reassess the pain and become healed. Once a person undergoes enough EMs, pays for enough classes, and begins moving up the ranks, or in this case, recruiting more and more people, until you become more whole and a better you. Doing these things also help you move up the ranks in the, quote, company of NXIVM. And the people who were in NXIVM were being told that they were changing the world, that this was the best place that you could possibly be because Keith has the highest IQ of anyone in the world. He's the smartest man in the world. He knows everything. He's a master at everything. And because you're learning from him, you too are going to be a world changer. But it wasn't the ESP classes that made headlines. It was a separate, secret sect within NXIVM called DOS, which loosely translates from Latin meaning dominant over submissive. DOS was pitched as a secret group for women, by women, within NXIVM to help others reach greater lengths in their growth through the programs. Members of DOS had no idea that this group was actually created by Keith himself, along with his minion Allison Mack and a few other women who were at the top. Keith disguised himself behind these women in order to recruit women to be his, quote, sex slaves. So to get started, Allison and a few other top NXIVM women recruited others to join. To do so, all women had to give something called collateral, which is really just blackmail. Collateral could be anything damaging, from nude photos to telling untrue, horrific stories about your family or a loved one, or even giving away the deed to your home. Collateral had to do with something so embarrassing or shameful or important that you would never ever release any of DOS's secrets in fear that your collateral would be exposed. Once you're collateralized, you are now a slave, and the person who recruited you is your master. And you must obey everything your master tells you to do, because they're supposedly doing this to help you. One of the most shocking things to come out of DOS was the branding. Keith and Allison created a design with their initials, telling the rest of the women it was a symbol of the elements that would be branded on their hip or groin area as an exercise in overcoming pain. What it really did was force a submissive and dissociative state, causing the women to psychologically feel even more tied to their sisters and master in DOS. India was recruited into DOS pretty early on by Alice and Mac. India was indeed branded and recruited other women into DOS as well, making her a master to them. Something that I don't mention in the interview but is important to India's story is the sexual abuse that occurred within DOS. One of India's assignments from Allison was to seduce Keith. Allison told her that this was part of her growth, that it would help her be less self-conscious of her body, and Keith could help her heal. Now, I didn't mention a lot of these more painful elements of Nexium and DOS because I don't want to re-traumatize India, and I also don't want her to have to linger on a lot of the really negative aspects of what came out of the group. And I want to also encourage all of the listeners before listening to this interview to please be kind if you do reach out to her and to ask her respectful questions, just as you would for myself. Now that I know her a little better, I do feel a bit protective. Anyway, thanks to her mother and so many other people in her life that love her, India finally got out and is now able to see her experience in Nexium for what it was. Whenever I talk about a person on the show, I love to look up their astrological sign and what that may tell me about the person I'm about to talk about. When I looked up India's birthday, here's what it said. Geminis born on June 7th have the desire to make their presence felt in the world. They are curious and vibrant with an ability to keep their level of enthusiasm high, no matter what. When I read this description, it was funny to me how much it really did remind me of India, because so much of her story started with her curiosity and her wanting to make the world a better place. And her level of enthusiasm for making the world a better place was what made her such a powerful tool in Nexium. Now, I've never met India IRL, but a little over 2 years ago, I first heard her story in a docuseries for HBO. In it, her mom, Catherine Oxenberg, was heavily featured, and to me, Catherine emanated an energy that reminded me of my own mother. I read Catherine's book, Captive, and in it, I learned about the special relationship between Catherine and India, a relationship, again, that reminded me a lot of mine with my own mom. In 2020, when the world was locked up in their homes in quarantine, I listened to India's audiobook, Still Learning, on Audible. I listened to it in one sitting, and I was taken aback by how much India's story reminded me of my own. Not the specifics of the cult, but the feeling of being a 19-year-old girl who was abused and manipulated, and now being 30 years old and feeling like I'm still healing from some of the abuse I endured. I reached out to her when I finished listening to the book. I think I said something about wanting to be friends or something else super nerdy like that, but she actually responded. And ever since, we've had this online pen palship that's been really wonderful. I've been fortunate enough to have some really deep and meaningful conversations with her, and I can't wait to get to know her more and hopefully eventually in person as well. Knowing her a bit better now, I know India wants to make her presence known to the world in a positive light. She has a relentless pursuit of making other people and the world a better place, even if that led her astray at times in her life. India's enthusiasm and perseverance has been on display since leaving Nexium in 2018, taking down the man at the head of it all by helping the FBI and sharing her story with the world. I see a lot of myself in India, but I am also so inspired by her. I hope you all enjoy our conversation and come out of it loving India as much as I do. Oh my gosh. Well, I am so unbelievably happy to like finally meet you. I feel like I've kind of like known you my whole life in a weird way. It's been like a couple of years of like being internet pen pals. That's kind of wild.
Isn't it funny when that happens? Like I this whole world of social media is so cool to me. Like I hate it and I love it all at the same time, because it's not natural for me to be like, you know, interfacing with lots of people all the time. I'm way more of an introvert and
you do
soul.
It very naturally.
I try, and that's like what I prayed for. I was like, okay, so if this is supposed to work out, please let it come smoothly and like let it flow. Because there was a while where I was like, I didn't even want to go on Instagram, because one, like after all of the seduced press, there was so much of an influx of messages after all that press that I was like, I can't handle all of this at once.
No.
So I started to just like chip away at it. And then I was like, wait, okay, this is manageable. I can do this. Like, I know who some of these people are. Hence our relationship. Like,
yeah.
I know like how much time I want to spend on here. Realistically, this is not how I make money. This is not my job.
Right. But exactly.
A platform that I feel like is super valuable. And I've like made a lot of interesting connections. I've been able to just relate with all sorts of folks and different brands that I would have never had contact with. So like that is really quite cool.
It is the amazing thing, especially for me during the pandemic. I've never really used social media as a means of like meeting people. So like even reaching out to you and things like that, it was never something that I had to do before, because I was always like out in the world. But for you in particular, so I watched The Vow like everyone else when it came out. And I was like, I've always been very interested in both psychology and true crime stuff. Like I really wanted to be a child like abnormal psychologist when I was little, but I was told I was too stupid to do it. So I never went for it.
I think that's such a niche market that's really underserved.
Yeah. And I had like the best child's therapist growing up too. So I was like, that would be cool.
I had my mom. So basically like I had somebody reinforcing that magic existed, but if I didn't, I think I would have been really lost and felt really lonely. And I definitely felt lonely. Even having a mom.
Yeah. We both have amazing moms. Like that's the other thing that I love about you, but I've always had this like weird fascination with like, I guess growing up, my mom was really into like the Charles Manson, the really creepy, scary, whatever. But to me, I've always connected more with the human side of the psychology amongst all of that. And when I was, 18, I moved to LA and I immediately got into a very abusive relationship that I was in for years. And I really think it was because that I was in such a vulnerable position. It was around the same time that my eating disorder started. I had been dealing with self-harm since I was very little. And I also was starting to act and be an actress. So I was having all of this like external judgment coming at me. And then also this incredible manipulation from somebody that I loved who was really abusing me. And so when I hear about these, high control groups, things like that, it doesn't seem that crazy to me. it really was something that I very much like resonated with and understood. And your story in particular, we're practically the same age. I think you're like, I did a little research on you. So you're June of 91.
I'm 31.
Okay.
And
so
I just turned 31 in June.
Yeah. I just turned 30 in July.
Oh, we're about a year apart.
I'm July 92. So hearing your story, especially because we're about the same age, we kind of went through that same transitional period at the same time. The other thing that jumped out about you right away was your relationship with your mom. And so my mom and I are incredibly like too close. Like we had to go to therapy to like cut the umbilical cord a little bit.
Later years. Yeah. I think that's like a layer after layer process.
Me and my mom were really this unit and we were always together. And she was like,
we were a team. Basically.
Yes.
I had a mom dad too, for a lot of my life. And so I was like, oh, these dads, they're nonsense. Like you don't even need them.
Exactly. Okay. I still kind of feel that way. I'm not lying. I'm always like, hashtag not all dads, but like,
tell me some good ones. That's where I'm saying, I'm like, where are the good daddies? And like, to be real, like I respect my dad. He's been a fine father, but he wasn't the typical father that I was looking for. And I was, in my mind as a little girl, you have a fantasy of what your dad is supposed to be like. And if it doesn't match, you know, you've got years of disappointment and daddy issues to work out.
It's devastating.
But I totally relate to you about being a unit. Like,
yeah,
that is a particularly challenging relationship because you don't even realize that, like, it's hard to determine, like, who's who.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it's like, you have to, like, kind of learn your own autonomy as you get older, because if you grew up feeling like such a unit, it is really hard to separate yourself from that in a lot of ways. But I know that, like, you know, so your mom got remarried when you were, like, still fairly young and you got siblings and all that kind of stuff. Was that, like, a weird thing for you to go from being an only child to having all these siblings? I'm an only child, so I can't imagine what it would be like to suddenly have siblings.
Definitely. It was weird, but I wanted to touch upon something that you said earlier about, like, your experience with abuse and how when you did watch my story, you didn't see it as all that different. I mean, I talk about that a lot in interviews and podcasts, because I think it's really important for people to see that this is, like, a cult of one also exists. Like, you don't need to be in a high control group or in a cult, quote unquote, to be experiencing these types of abuses, especially like psychologically and physically. So I just think that that's important for people to not brush off, because I think a lot of times people want to compare traumas and they're like, oh, well, yours was in the news, or it was so, you know, salacious and like all of these things.
So maybe mine's not as bad.
Right. And that's not true. That's not true at all. Like if you strip away the content, the experience that we had is pretty much the same.
Yeah.
It's like the effects that it had on my psychology, the effects that it had on my body, that it had on my hormones, that it had on my mental capacity to understand what was real and what was not.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, I had a cult-induced eating disorder for sure, for years.
Yeah.
And so, like, all of these kinds of coping strategies, I had chronic pain, I had depression, I had suicidal ideation. I mean, all of these things are things that people that experience abuse can relate to. So, like, I don't really care about comparing trauma. I just care about people feeling heard and recognized and understood, because I think that's what we all want anyway.
And I think it's important also, because then people don't see your experience as being that crazy. Cause I think it's really easy for a lot of people to be very judgmental and to be like, oh, well, that would never happen to me. I would never be a part of that. I would never fall victim to that. I wouldn't fall for it. And I think that that's really easy for people to live in this, like, very protective bubble. But then when you can translate it into more of, like, an everyday trauma, if you want to put it that way, something that's like more people can understand, it makes situations like yours seem less, like, out there. You know what
out
I mean?
This world, exactly. They're all in this world. But, like, now to answer your question about family of origin, because I feel like that has a lot to do with how we set ourselves up for the rest of our lives.
Right.
But I did come from predominantly a mother acting as a mom dad for the first 7 years of my life. And then I had a stepfather who came into my life, and he had two children who were 2 and 5. At the time. And unfortunately, they had a lot of abuse from their mother. And so they became my mom and my stepdad became the sole custody of those children, who are my stepbrother and sister. So it was really startling for me, because I had not experience like yelling and screaming and violence and all of these things. And, like, in a way, I kind of had a, like, even though it was unconventional, because my mom was also a working actress, I had lots of nannies and caretakers and different folks for different times. She even went to rehab at a certain point when I was really little. So, like, she had an extended support system taking care of me. Like, it takes a village, more or less.
Yeah.
But, I had a lot of love, and I had a lot of like wonder in my life. And, like, I was able to be an only child outside, hanging out with my cat in the trees, and, like, like life was good.
Yeah.
And so like, I remember my childhood feeling that way. I remember feeling free and feeling like I could talk to adults and I didn't feel shy. Yes. And I didn't feel shame.
Uh-huh.
And I think it wasn't until I entered school that I started to really develop complexes. So I was about 5 when I went into kindergarten and I left a school called Waldorf, which was super alternative education for preschool.
I think I totally know what Waldorf is. I mean, just being in the nanny spheres, I like know so many random schools in the area.
And it was perfect for me and my little kind of artsy brain. And like, I thrived there. And then they threw me into a regular public school and I was fucking terrified.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to read. So
So you were diagnosed with dyslexia. Yeah. I'm like, let's clarify. Like she's literate. She just,
I also wrote a book. So
I know. Exactly.
Like all of this dyslexia nonsense and all of the slapping of a label on a really young child actually did quite a bit of damage.
It's disheartening. It really is. Yeah.
The same way that I appreciate that you spoke about the child that you're going to take care of as having lots of energy. Like when people are like, oh, that kid's ADHD, I want to be like, shut the fuck up. Do you forget what it's like to be 3 years old?
Yes.
Like you have a lot of energy, you idiot.
You have a lot of energy. And also like everything is new and exciting. You want to explore. Wonder. You're curious. Exactly. And it helps me stay that way as well. You know, I love getting those little like bits of childhood back. And I think that's why as much as I'm like, I'm never going to be a nanny again, I always end up taking care of kids.
I'm so passionate about this because I feel like it really relates to just my story on a whole is like when you get a label slapped down on you, either by society or by your family, or by yourself.
Yeah.
It's like, sometimes you feel like you're condemned to that forever and it doesn't feel flexible. It doesn't feel like anything you could change. Like, you could say the same thing I could say the same thing about myself when I was put into the news when Nexium was exposed. Like it was branded sex slave.
Yes.
Girl.
Yeah.
And it was like, and I, for a while I was like, is that really going to be how people know me for the rest of my life? Like, like I'm India Oxenberg. Like I know who I am, but like, I didn't also know who I was at that point because I was going through a transitional period of really
re-entering the world. It would be hard to defend yourself at that point. Yeah.
It was. Yeah. It was really hard. I was like,
well, there was work that you had to do on you.
Yeah. I was like, I know I'm not that, but like something bad definitely happened and I can't quite figure it out.
Yeah.
And so just like so much of processing that I had to do. And so like, you know, take it back to how I was raised. I was raised in like an unconventional household and really all I craved was normalcy and structure and reliability and truth, like pretty much all kids.
Yeah.
And I didn't get that all the time. And so I think I went out in the world looking for that in other people and also looking for kind of like a makeshift family without even really being conscious of it.
I think that that's common for someone who's like, you know, 17, 18, 19 going out into the world. They're like, it's now my time to create my own family.
Yeah.
Exactly. And start experimenting with, you know, being around different types of people and trying different things. But I think talking about, you know, structure and lack thereof growing up makes a lot of sense into, you know, your next phase of life. Like, what do you think, how do you think that played into you first taking your first classes with, like, it's the ESP classes, right? That start with, and then
you're totally right.
Go on from there. You and your mom, and this is totally something my mom and I would have done. We actually totally fell for one of those like acting talent cruise ship things. But you know, like it's totally something my mom and I would have been like, oh, it's going to be this like growth and learning class. Let's go together. Like, can you talk a little bit about what that decision was like, just kind of looking back, like, hey, mom, let's check this out. What's it about?
It was just like what you said. I mean, ironically, like looking back, I wish that I would have been more thoughtful about it, but it was purely instinct. Like,
why should you have been more thoughtful?
That's the thing is like, I wasn't, but like, you know, hindsight is 20/20 and you look back and you're like, nowadays, you know, before I do things, I research, like, yeah, I do a little bit of work. I ask people, like, not always. Sometimes I do go on my instinct because I trust myself now. But at the time I was young and I was vulnerable and I was in a transitional period of my life. That's why I say I'm vulnerable, not because I was necessarily more naive than the average person.
Right.
But I was 19 and I was looking for structure and I had just left university and I was home and I was like, hey, mom, just like you just said, hey, do you want to go to this intro? Like our friend, our trusted friend has told us that this freaking thing is awesome. Right. So why don't we go and check it out? And
innocent enough.
And it seemed pretty cool. Like in the intro presentation, I was like, this is interesting. Like I have fears that are stopping me from getting what I want. Like I want to remove those fears. I just remember raising my hand up and going like, that's me. I'm the one with interference from my childhood. And they're like, all right, simmer down there, little girl. But like,
oh no, in the back of their head, they're like, hold on to this one.
Oh yeah.
We got to reel her in.
And that's the thing is like I talk about this a lot because I think that we're confused about what it means to be vulnerable. What it means to be vulnerable is to really believe that there's something wrong with you when there are not.
Yeah.
And that's how people can exploit you. So like the fact that I believe that there was something wrong with my brain because I had dyslexia, the fact that I believe that there was something wrong with me because I was 19 and I didn't have my shit together. Also really, really outrageous thought. The thought that I thought that I needed to be anywhere else but where I was, also putting pressure on myself unnecessarily. Like all of those things made me vulnerable to people who seemingly had the answers.
Yeah, exactly.
Or that I look to as authority figures. So like, it really just depends on where you're at in your life and what you're looking for and what you feel like you need in order to be whole, because those little holes that need filling can be filled by great things or they can be filled by manipulative people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, talking about the innocence of the whole thing is also really important because like they're telling you all of these things that everybody wants to improve about themselves in their lives. Like everybody wants to remove those fears that keep us from becoming successful. And then I feel like also, you know, and you can probably speak on this a little bit more, the perception that I get from just what I've consumed about Nexium is that there was probably a lot of love bombing going into the beginning. And there was a lot of making you feel very special and wanted. And like you said, you were now, that's me, you know, and they were like, this is somebody that could be really helpful to us. And they make you feel so supported and loved that even when things make you feel uncomfortable, you still feel like you can trust those people. Am I getting it a little bit right?
Yeah, you do. Okay. You do. And I think you also probably get it even more so because you've done work on yourself from your, you know, your unfortunate abusive relationship, because that's the same path that someone would take in a high control group, or if they were trying to, you know, lure a potential mate.
Yeah, exactly.
So like, it's the same stuff. It's the same stuff that I didn't know what to look for, because those were also blind spots for me when it comes to charismatic people who say a lot of things, but don't really deliver.
Well, you were raised in LA. I've lived in LA for 12 years. I feel like there's a lot of people like that around you in general. So it's almost hard to be like, who's real, who's not.
It's the land of Lala. Like there's so much phoniness that I thought I actually had a really good bullshit detector.
Of course.
Because I generally did, but you know, right place, wrong time, because I was, now looking back, I can go, oh my God, like little 19-year-old India, like you definitely had this blind spot because you actually thought that there was something wrong with you.
Yeah.
Like, that was the running theme that they really exploited, both financially and with my time and with my network. So it was like one of the things that they loved about me and that they, you know, talk about love bombing was that they're like, this girl's local. Like, let's tap into all the people that she knows so that she can, you know, through her trusted network, because people trust me, that she will be able to recruit people. And the truth is, like, I tried so hard to recruit people, and I recruited a very small number of people into Nexium, into DOS on a whole, like the whole 7 years that I was there. It was really hard because I was selling a bullshit lie.
Right.
And I was brainwashed into believing that it was the fucking bee's knees.
Of course.
So I was like, I was going around, you know, using my skills, which is like my love and my connection to people, to do something that ultimately deep down I didn't believe in, but I had to actually convince myself to fully believe in it, because it was like, otherwise I was living in two different worlds, and the world that I had to commit to was this world that Nexium was creating for me, which was not my life. That's weird for people to kind of like conceptualize, but if you have been in an abusive relationship, you understand the experience of like you disappearing and this kind of other persona that's really about self-preservation and getting love and feeling like
being protected,
a piece of shit. And being protected and feeling like you have no value because that's what you're being told to. And then you become a shell of yourself.
Yeah.
It's creepy, but it happened.
No, it's totally true. And I can also imagine that through trying to get other people that you love and care about to be part of this same group as you would also be very like isolating as well, because you're telling people about it and some people are really seeing it for what it is. And I almost feel like that's almost a cultish tactic as well, because as you're more open about it, you're closing in that circle of people that can give you more perspective, because you're only surrounding yourself with people that agree with you. Right.
Yep. You're exactly right. That's like one of their main tactics for what is the term is predatory alienation.
Okay.
So basically like the predator will alienate you from your support system or from those that know you and convince you that the reason why there's distance is because they don't get you. They don't understand you like us.
Yeah.
We understand you. We support your highest values. So there's like a lot of seduction, really.
Yes. Yeah.
About, you know, who loves you most,
who's there for
you most. And then at the same time, you are pulling away from your friends and family. So you do feel alone. You do feel distant. So like there's enough truth in the way that they're manipulating that you also start to believe, but you're being coerced.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that you don't realize.
You think that you truly believe it, but you don't. It's not authentic with who you are. I mean, you were even further isolated. I mean, tell me how the hell you ended up in Albany. Never been. Doesn't look like a hip happen in town. I mean, you were pulled from everything.
Wouldn't be the top of your list for travel.
So I should cross it out of my to-do list for my
it's got some pretty, you know, it's got some pretty parts like Saratoga Springs and things like that. And
I'm sure
it's upstate New York. So like it's got all those.
I'm sure there are lovely people. I'm sure there are lovely coffee shops, you know.
Kind of. I'm spoiled. But
totally.
I would say that I got there because the courses that they offered that I wanted to complete were in Albany. And so like part of their process of recruiting was seeing who would actually go there, like who they could get to Albany. And then they had all of this mystique around like...
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Albany and Keith, and like it was like the freaking Wizard of Oz. So like you didn't really know what you were coming to, but you kind of knew that you were going there for no distractions, and like you're just going there to work on your personal growth. That was right. Kind of like how it was pitched to me.
You were like the most dedicated.
Yeah, and that was cool.
Yeah.
Like in the group, that was cool.
But I feel like for people who are like, you know, if you're a perfectionist or if you're a people pleaser, like of course you want to be like the most dedicated, the best at what you do, all that kind of stuff. So like what was that like for you to completely remove yourself from not just like your usual surroundings, but like, you know, speaking of you and your mom being such a unit, you know, when you first started, you know, you had kind of gone through it together. Your mom was like, this seems weird, I'm out. And then suddenly, you know, you're still very young, moving all the way across the country from all of your support. Do you feel like what was that experience like for you?
Well, some things happened in between that. So like my mom stayed a student for several months, like probably a little less than a year. Okay. And within that time period, I was also a student, but then they started to heavily recruit me to be a coach. And in order to be a coach, you had to finish your 16-day program. And that, like, to finish it, you had to go to Albany.
Okay.
So that was really the reason why I went initially. Then throughout the, you know, we're talking the full 7 years that mm-hmm. I was there. In the middle of those years, I was going back and forth from LA to Albany to take courses
and to
train myself. So I was kind of like living two lives, almost like this NXIVM life that was building itself and that I was really becoming involved in the community. And then, you know, periodically jumping back into my old life in LA. So I was straddling both worlds. It wasn't until I was about 24, 25, when I was recruited into DOCS, which was the cult within the cult, right, that I then had to relocate completely and really leave everything behind as like a command.
Yeah.
And so, and that was when I was collateralized. So I really didn't have the choice to say no at that point anymore. And like people, you know, the invisible chains were already there. Like I was already very much involved to the point where I felt like I couldn't leave. Now on top of it comes DOCS.
You really couldn't leave.
Really when I couldn't leave. Yeah.
What do you think made you so desirable for something like DOS?
Well, I think because I was so committed to what I thought was my growth within Nexium, like within the bubble of Nexium, that I was a target, because I was already so primed with all of their indoctrination that it wasn't really that hard for them to recruit me. Like, they, you know, it was Alice and Mac who recruited me directly. And I guess you could say that I mean, I don't really consider myself Keith's type, because that seems like weird, because I never really even thought of him in that way at all. So even when I was talking to the FBI later on, they were like, well, didn't you just see that this was all for sexual gratification? I literally laughed out loud. I was like, what? Like,
no, really? That's not like how this was presented to me.
Yeah, I was like, that's not what they told me. And I'm like, oh, that the weird sexual stuff that he does, like, oh, that's like going to the doctor. Like my mind was so twisted up by their lies and their stories that I didn't even know what was, you know, what right from left was.
Of course.
It was so backwards. But like, cut to living there was very strange. Like, now that I'm in my own life, which I actually feel like is dictated by me and the things that I want to do.
Uh-huh.
It's so fucking weird to think about my life in Nexium. It's like a different person.
Yeah.
Because it was like, it was structured. It was militant. There was no rest. There was no vacation. There was no leisure time. There was no, like, anything that you did for pleasure was criticized.
Right.
Like, there was no drinking. There was no drugs. There was no just sex for enjoyment.
That was
there
the was one no, thing. Like, every time I've consumed anything Nexium, I'm like, I would need to be wasted.
I wish I was wasted. I mean, like, now looking back, I was so scared of drinking. Like,
oh my gosh.
When I came out of it, I was like, fuck, did I just like go through like 7 years of basic sobriety? I mean, but in a way I did, even though there were times that I had, I don't think I did any drugs, to be honest, when I was in all of Nexium, and like, I love smoking weed. So like, I don't know how I got through that, but I did.
Right.
And now I have some amazing tools.
Oh my God. I know. I'm like, you and I,
healing on the other side.
You and I need to talk about like hallucinogens someday. Oh, we just need to have a whole separate like conversation about all of that, 'cause I am like so fucking fascinated by all of that. But oh,
there's
my gosh.
More soon for that, by the way, because we're putting out a website that's all about the psychedelic lifestyle, with or without psychedelics. The emphasis is healing. My mom and I are doing it through our foundation. So so we'll have tons of information on the website coming soon. Down the line, a couple years down the line, we're building a brick and mortar healing center on the land that burned down when we lost our home. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. So just like tangent, but that's
what a
those
full, single, beautiful moment. I love that.
Out of the ashes, we're going to rebuild it into something that actually helps people. And really, it kind of stems from both of our origin stories, because when I got out of Nexium and when I was kind of like going through in and out of being in a psychosis for a while,
I kept
calling my mom and being like, I want to die. Like, please send me. I was like, send me somewhere. Where can I go? And she would like look up rehabs or places like that. But none of these things fit the bill, because they didn't focus on like the root of trauma. They focused on the symptoms of either like you have an eating disorder, or you're a drug addict, or you're manic depressive, here's a pill. So like our whole approach to healing has been way more like dynamic.
Well, you had to kind of build the wheel.
Body. Yeah.
You know,
and
because
we've been doing it together, and now we're like putting this stuff out there so that we can be like, yo, we did it really quickly. Like, In a sense, like, we've been able to figure out how to make this less expensive, faster, more approachable, because healing should not just be for people with means. Like, that is ridiculous.
Right.
Like, everyone should have access to healing if they want it.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I wish we could just talk about happy, lovely things.
Yeah,
the
I know.
Time.
Well, that was just a tangent.
Yes, exactly. I do always want to focus more on the positives, but I think that it's important to understand a little bit about, you know, the intricacies of what DOS is as well. I think that from what I've learned, it was very much presented as this, like, it was kind of during the whole girl boss movement. It was around the same time as like LuLaRoe and like that whole.
Definitely was. And then it imploded with Me Too. Which yes. is really ironic.
Isn't it? It's so funny yeah. because like it sounds like it's this like female empowerment great thing, but it's like it acts as the total opposite.
Enslavement.
It is.
Like, I mean, now I can fucking laugh about it a little bit, but like it was horrendous.
Yes.
Like it was horrendous. It was abusive. It was twisted. It was sadistic.
Well, like, talk a little bit about just like your daily life, because I know a little bit about readiness drills and things like that. Just however much you want. You don't need to go into crazy detail.
Yeah, let's see.
But like, if you could just paint a chaotic picture for us all.
Well, like that's the weird part is like, it wasn't so much chaos on the outside. It was more chaos on the inside because you were always like seemingly busy, but you were busy because nothing that you were doing was working. So it was like being on a hamster wheel. It's not like how we work in the world where it's I put an effort and then I get, you know, something back.
I get a result like, from that.
Yeah,
effort.
It was like, you're just putting an effort and putting an effort. It was like feeling like you were slamming your head up against the wall because you weren't actually getting any real tangible results.
Were you getting any validation? Because I feel like that would be the
occasionally,
one thing you would, right.
Occasionally. And that was, you know, nice. So if you got validation here and there, that was kind of like a little carrot dangling forward. And then it kept you going. But like, really, the day was pretty monotonous. It was kind of like living, I was living in a bubble. Like I would go to class. I would do my work for DOS. I would do my practices for DOS. I was, you know, very, very focused on such a small world because it was more on how much I could eat, when I could eat, when I had to stop eating. Like, you know what it's like to have an eating disorder. Like you can't think about anything else. It's like your whole life is around basically being too fat or too skinny or too this or too that.
Like, well, and they're insane. Also just like when you are losing that amount of weight too, what was explained to me when I was truly in my sickest was it's like your brain is not functioning because you haven't had enough nutrients. And that is such a terrible tool that was used against you all. That is so sad to me because you didn't have the choice in that matter. You know, I made some choices in ways that I was able to self-soothe myself throughout my life that were probably not the best ways to do so. But this was encouraged amongst all of you and all of
strongly,
you were placed.
It was mandatory. It wasn't even just encouraged because they had us all like, whoever they wanted on a starvation diet, they put on the starvation diet. And it was really a way to control you. And I didn't even know that. Like what you just said is really brilliant because it wasn't until I started working with the FBI that they actually said, like, you know, you were not in your right mind.
Yes.
Like, you're running on 500 calories for like over a year.
Which like, is literally, it's impossible.
Insane.
It's insane. I ended
losing
up in a hospital
hair.
Before then. You know what I mean? Like
I didn't have periods.
And you
then
weren't
what
sleeping.
I wasn't sleeping. It was sleep deprivation, food deprivation. And we were like on a fucking high for it too. That's the crazy part. Is
because
like,
people don't understand the euphoria that can come along with that. Because it's in short bursts, but you do
control.
Get this high. Isn't it? Isn't it all about that sweet, sweet control and the perceived control that you had over yourself too. Not even thinking about the fact that you had to relay
it
back
together.
To somebody else. To you, it was like, I am doing this for my own
that's what
betterment.
I believed because that's what I had to believe really for my own sanity at that point. Like if I had actually like popped out of the delusion and the brainwashing at that point, I don't know if I would have made it because I think I would have been so disturbed to realize
you wouldn't have recognized yourself.
No, and I actually didn't recognize myself. That's the trippiest part is that when I left, I remembered for a long period before I had left the cult, I didn't look at myself in the mirror. Like I didn't make eye contact. And I remember recognizing that and going, that's funny. Like I used to look at myself. Like I used to put on makeup. I used to brush my hair and look at it. Like I didn't do it anymore. I didn't even like it. It didn't feel good. It actually made me feel bad when I looked at myself.
Yeah.
So then, you know, coming out of it in my healing years, the past four and a half, whatever it's been.
Right.
I started to recognize that like a lot of growth came from how I saw myself in the mirror, because I could see myself, but I couldn't feel myself. And I was like, I don't recognize this person because it doesn't feel like me. And so it was like slowly regaining myself layer after layer after layer, body, mind, spirit, soul, like whatever I needed to get myself back was what I focused on.
Yeah, exactly.
Really hard.
Incredibly hard. And the other thing that is just so disheartening to me about your story is that not only were you indoctrinated into this group, but you were also so pressured to bring other people in.
Yeah.
And as a person, so I was raised Catholic. I always talk about the Catholic guilt. I always talk about how I have a hard time.
I have survivor's guilt.
Right. And I think that there's also a lot of like issues that we can have with forgiving ourselves when we either have perceived to or have, you know, hurt other people in a way.
It was so hard.
Yeah. What was that like for you?
I mean, honestly, like that really was fucking disturbing. Like when I had to confront what I had done in the eyes of the law and that I was a cooperating witness for a reason. And I had a lot to say, and I didn't even realize what I had experienced to the fullness until like it took years to really realize the fullness of what had happened.
Right.
And the fact that I brought in women into DOS was like devastating to me because I really, really believed when I was there that this was good.
Yeah.
And like, I was not in my right mind, and I've gone out of my way to make amends with some of those people who wanted to.
Right.
And there's been healing there. And then others, they wanted to just part ways. And I was understanding about that.
Yeah.
But
and that's also
part
of the healing process as well.
So hard. Cause it's like every time I went out to, you know, make a new friend or rekindle an old relationship with women specifically, I was scared. And I was like, do I trust myself yet? Like, do I feel like me? Are they going to trust me? Or like, am I a good person? Am I a monster? Mm. Like all of these, you have all of these thoughts. And you question yourself so deeply when you go through something like that, because I never wanted, I am not somebody who likes to hurt people, like even just accidentally. And the fact that well-intentioned people can still do bad things is a reality.
Yeah, exactly.
When you're being brainwashed and manipulated and coerced. Yeah. So like that it happens.
Yes.
It's hard.
You brought up something that I've never really even thought about, and that is like rebuilding female friendships after all of that. I've never even really considered that. What was that like? And also, like, I mean, I think another important thing is that the person in charge of all of this was so incredibly misogynistic and patriarchal and shitty that there was a specific way that, you know, a woman had to be and a man had to be and all of these things. How did you navigate all of that? Because to me, you know, from an outsider's perspective, you seem to be a pretty, you know, liberal feminist woman who went through this, you know, experience. How did you kind of like unlearn those really unhealthy misogynistic teachings and rebuild your future into like having real female friendships and trusting yourself? Like what was that picture like for you?
Once again, layer after layer of healing, because you're right. I was a misogynist. Like I had thoughts that were very anti-feminist. Like I had thoughts about women that didn't feel natural to me, about myself, about my, like the value that I possessed, what I was here for in the world. Was I just here to be like a dairy cow? Like, was I like, literally I had thoughts like that I had never possessed. And I was not raised that way either. Like my mom is a feminist.
Oh yeah.
And like all about girl power. And like, that's what I was raised with. I feel like women are incredible. And like, especially when we work together.
Yeah.
And so like all of that felt really like unnatural, I guess is the way to describe it. But it had also started to feel like me because I had been replaced with this new like version of myself. It sounds really sci-fi, but that is kind of how it felt. And I just kind of remember like if I had any deep opinions that I knew weren't in agreement with their philosophy, I kept them to myself. I didn't really share them. I tried not to provoke. I tried to be a people pleaser. I tried to, you know, be on board. It was easier that way. It made you less of a target, even though you were
always a
target.
Well, I was going to say you didn't have to worry about being chastised or made fun of. You wouldn't have been said let's talk about that. You know, why would you fight it when you know that you're going to be punished for speaking your opinion?
Exactly. So that's kind of what my subconscious and my nervous system started to be trained to do, mm-hmm. which was just suppress, 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 and just go with the doctrine, try to do your best, but being you is not safe, basically.
Right.
Like being myself and being having the opinions that I have, which are strong opinions and now much more informed opinions about life and relationships and men and women than they were then.
Yeah.
But even then I had plenty of experiences, but nowadays I know that if I was ever put into a situation where I had somebody who said something that was like that, I would have words to say. Totally. I would not be silenced, and I wouldn't be scared into being silenced, but the environment was really scary because of the level of punishment or humiliation, lots mm-hmm. of public humiliation. And that really works for many people.
My abuser was an incredible misogynist and had some terrible nicknames for me, and the humiliation was I think definitely a really big manipulation factor in that as well. And that is a very strong silencer as well, because you don't want to be put on the spot, or you don't want to be the different one as well when you want to be accepted. Okay, where were we? Yeah, so rebuilding those female friendships, what was that like for you? Just making friends after all of that in general.
So hard.
Yeah. Well, you met your now husband shortly after, during that time too.
And that was, honestly, I feel like a gift from God, because I wasn't looking for a boyfriend at all. I couldn't give two fucks about guys at that point. I was like, can everybody just leave me F alone.
Yes.
No girlfriends, no guy friends, no this, no that. I just wanted to have my own thoughts with myself and not be bombarded by everyone, because that's kind of how I felt when I was coming out of the cult.
Totally.
Was just completely bombarded, and I didn't know what my thought was.
Yeah. Well, and the media was also very heavily fixated on you, I feel like, because of how hard your mom was fighting to get you out. So you really didn't have any privacy. It was
no.
Here she is, everybody.
Yeah, I was like, yay, joy. Everyone's in my underwear drawer. Cool.
literally, it's crazy. Yeah. But what was that
easy,
like?
And it wasn't easy at all. And I think what I've had to, I guess the biggest part of that is being vulnerable and being honest with people, because that's kind of where I've seen the most growth for myself, is in the relationships that I wanted to have, whether they be new ones. I just had to be me, and that it was really scary at first, and I thought people were going to reject me for what I had experienced or who I was or how I think, and how I think about the world and how I think about these issues. And then I slowly started to interface with reality and even rekindle old friendships that I had lost, the friendships that I had had pre-cult and even as a child. And that was really cool, because I started to get parts of myself back. And then I also started to feel safer with women and opening up and then collaborating with them and working with them and appreciating them. And it was it was just a one thing, a one shot and done. It was layer after layer of different pieces that had been lost that had to come back together.
Yeah, it's just so interesting, because I feel like our culture has already taught young girls that women are our competition, whether it be for a guy or for a job or whatever. And I think that we, as women, all have had that thought in some time in our lives, or we felt that way. And then yours was just at such an extreme level that I can only imagine that vulnerability and being able to open yourself up to female friendships when they had been so damaging to you in the past.
And
you
males.
Had been, yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even, I mean, it's just funny.
My mantra for myself was okay, can I be a feminist who also loves men, because I do love men. I appreciate men. I think what they bring is super valuable, but I was so fucking angry at them for
what you don't love
level
is
of abuse.
What you don't love is toxic men and toxic behavior. I think that's the thing.
I had to like separate all of these things out of my mind and be like, okay, what does India care about? What are my needs? First of all, like, I just didn't even know what I needed. And then how can I communicate my needs? That was a whole layer of therapy that I needed deeply.
Well, yeah. And I mean, that's something that I'm sure you weren't expecting with like meeting Patrick when you first, that's his name, right? I'm remembering it correctly.
Patrick, yeah.
Okay, awesome.
Good work.
Thank you. Meeting him and, you know, as you're kind of getting out of that, you're not only learning how to give yourself what you need, but you're also navigating like being in a relationship. What was he like in supporting you through all of that in the beginning of your relationship and everything?
I think it's definitely a learning curve for him, continual learning curve for both of us when it comes to relating authentically, which can sometimes be not cute.
Of course.
but it's helpful. I think for him, he just saw me as like a normal girl. And I just really appreciated that. And I was like, finally, like somebody just sees me for who I am and how I am. And I didn't feel like he associated me with Nexium, although it was difficult to separate the two at the time because I was so saturated with it.
Right.
But the more that we spent time together, the more he got to know the me that was starting to emerge out of, you know, really being suffocated and drowned for 7 years. And like, I felt like I was crawling out to get air. And like, each time I would get air, I'd be like, oh, this is my life. And then I would fall back and I would get depressed again, or I would feel anxious, or I'd feel like the PTSD would take over and I'd be in, you know, a pretty bad trauma flare up for days or weeks.
Right.
On end. And then it would be like intermittent, like sort of strobing, like I would be out of it and then I'd be in. And he was so patient with it and so non-judgmental, but also so scared because he was like, what is happening to this person? Like, it was so hard for him to see me in pain. And I didn't know how to explain myself because, like I said, there was no roadmap for this.
No.
And healing is not linear. So I was like, what the fuck is wrong with me? Like, am I ever going to get my brain back? Am I always going to be like this? When will I get relief? Like,
that's a lot of pressure.
A lot of pressure. And then to be in a relationship with someone where I kept saying like, can you just leave me already? Because I'm such a fucking mess. I don't want you to be near me and I'm going to hurt you when I'm not in a good place.
Aww.
Because I didn't feel stable inside emotionally.
Right. He trusted you more than you trusted yourself, I think, in that relationship, which is really important. I'm a big fan. Don't know the guy.
Aww.
Big fan. He seems lovely.
He's such a good egg. And like, he really is. Like, he has a good heart and he wants to learn and he wants to do well and he's a hard worker. He's a simple guy, like, and I think that's what I needed. Not simple in his mind, but simple in his needs.
Like, yes,
he wants to have good food, he wants to be with his friends, he wants to cook, he wants to be in nature, he wants to hunt. And like, that was the thing that I think I needed, was a good friend who knew what they liked. Because all of a sudden I was like, wait, he likes things. We like some things together and we like things separately. Like, instead of having to be the person that suppresses all of their needs and then just becomes a servant to whomever you're with, you actually get to be a person that's in the relationship.
Exactly.
And like also has needs. And I had never really had healthy models of that in my life.
Yeah. You really had to kind of like figure out what that meant for yourself. I think particularly in a time where that would be incredibly difficult. I think that it's really, it's
and
pretty
COVID.
Amazing. And COVID. Oh my God. On top of it all, you guys were just like stuck together really after that.
Yeah,
did you spend it together for the most part?
Yeah. All of it. Like we've pretty much, I mean, besides like a couple months here and there each year, because he's taken time to study in Italy. I've also had work. So we've had like long extended periods of time where we've been separated. Otherwise we've been together, like together, you know, driving cross country several times.
Yeah. You really just look like you have the funnest life, truly.
Oh, like my goal is for my outside life to match my inside life. So like that's what I strive for every day. I mean, that's why I think microdosing is so important for me in my healing journey, because it's been able to like balance my emotions inside to the way that I want to experience my life on the outside. And
exactly.
So like that was quite difficult for me for a really long time to get a handle on. And so I think like healing in general is complicated, but there's also lots of things out there that can really make it less lonely.
Yeah. One of my favorite words in the English language is authenticity. How do you feel that, and we've kind of already talked about this a little bit throughout our conversation, but how do you feel that you've been able to find those things that you like or find your authenticity? And who do you see India as being right now?
Oh, that's a cool question to close with. I have really, really tried to follow a couple rules for myself. One, get rid of all the other rules. Two, be myself unapologetically. And whatever that is, when it comes to the way I speak, the way I dress, the way I move, the way I dance, the way I eat, the way I express myself. Like, how could I do that without having self-judgment? Or really stopping myself because I'm afraid of other people judging me. Like that is free. That is freedom to me. And I like really strive for that. And then to be myself authentically is really to just be honest and to be honest with me first, and then have the bravery to be honest with others, because that takes it to the next level. And like, that is also very freeing, but can be really scary.
Yeah.
But also like, and to a certain extent, like, what do you have to lose? Like, the relationship with you, it should be free. It should be fluid. There should be nowhere that you can't go in your own mind. Like, I tell myself a lot, like, my mind is a safe place. My mind is a safe place because I want it to be. And I also know that, like, when it comes to my most personal relationships, that's where I struggle the most. So, like, that's where I need the most courage to be me. And feel okay with that.
Yeah.
So like, that's my daily practice. And like, I think it comes in lots of different forms and it's a work in progress. And like, I wrote a book called Still Learning for a Reason, because I feel like that's just what life is about.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, and I'm going to plug all of your goodies at the end. I absolutely loved your audiobook. I mean, that was what made me want to reach out and chat with you. I felt like I got to know you a little bit. I felt like you and I were very similar. I mean, you are a descendant of the royal family. My aunt invented the Dairy Queen Blizzard.
I love it.
We're like the same.
I need to get one.
I'm the Midwest version of royalty, baby.
Totally. I love that connection so much. And then I when you told me that, when you saw my comment, I was like, yes, I know someone from Dairy Queen.
I hope you really enjoyed that conversation as much as we did. If you want to know more about India, you can check out the docuseries that she and her mother created, Seduced, on Stars. I believe it's like a 3 or 4 part series, and it's so well done. Secondly, you can go ahead and follow her on Instagram at India Oxenberg. If you have anything to say about the episode, please shoot me an email at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com or send me a direct message on Instagram at @angryneighborhoodfeminist. If you want to get in touch with your fellow listeners, go ahead to the Facebook group page. And if you want to rate and review us on Facebook, we also have a business page. The best way that you can possibly support the show right now, though, is for you to go over to the Apple Podcasts app and leave a 5-star review with a quick sentence about why you enjoy the show. I've really appreciated all of the recent reviews, so let's keep them coming. All right, that's all we have for you today. With all of that being said, I encourage you to rage on. Bye.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.